Okay, I'm gonna get started. And we basically have 45 minutes. So this, I think most of you know my heart. This session is really about you.
Sorry.
So I have a list of questions that people have like us. But I will defer to you, of course. And basically what I'm going to do is I'm gonna take two questions at a time. If you wanna ask a particular member of the panel, you can say so, but it will just be an open question. Right? If you just want it for everyone. So I'll take two at a time, and then the panel will address. Most people do three at a time, but I hate when I'm on panels. I always forget the third one. So we'll take two at a time, and the whole panel will address the two, whoever wants to address it. Or if you want someone specific, you can ask them. So I'm just going to open the floor now, up to you guys. And when you do, introduce yourselves. If you know what type of social enterprise you want to do, you know, it also helps them to understand the room that they're in, and give them a little context, like, you know, not a song and dance, like literally 2 seconds high. I'm a member of the new masters in SIE, and you know, I want to do an ethical fashion business, or I want to do, if you kind of have any ideas. So okay, let's get started. First two victims. Yeah, let's start here.
Okay, I have a question for Sadiq from Peru. I'm native, I'm Argentinian, and I've been working with social entrepreneurs, micro entrepreneurs in the slums, like, around the city. And I wanted to know, like, if you had any incentives, payment incentives for the students that are getting involved, or how is the sustainability of that, or if it's just like getting experience with your CV or enhancing your capabilities, and how do you measure like the success of your project, and like if you, like, after a year, after 6 months, your entrepreneurs are, like, your micro entrepreneurs are able to scale up their businesses, and how is that measured?
Okay, that's cool. First question. Oh, yeah.
Okay, I have another question related to
you. Oh, South of Peru.
I am Andrea. I am from Colombia, and I have also, like, in my past worked with entrepreneurs, but they are particular artisans. And I'm interested in knowing how do you do the process of follow-up, like, with the entrepreneur and the student, and how do you get to link them together? Because I suppose not all of them are in the same city or in the same local area, and I know that artisans mainly live, like, in remote areas, so how do you get them together, how do you get them to connect?
Mm-hmm.
So, and how do you cover this cost of transportation or communication between them?
Okay, so the questions for those who can't hear at the back, it's for South of Peru. One about how do you remunerate the students, how do you assess success and failure and impact? The question in front here, how do you follow up and link your micro entrepreneurs, and how do you deal with some aspects of your business model, such as transport?
Yeah.
Should I just?
Yeah.
Great. So thank you for your questions. Very interesting. So yes, the first, to answer your first question, the payment incentives is that for the students, there's no payment. Our model works on the basis that the students are there to learn as well. So they received the capacity building program from us, which is a very unique curriculum on the topic of micro enterprise consultancy. And they received the curriculum on the soft skills. And the months that follow up on that, where they analyze the enterprise and implement the advices, is also for them a learning experience. So that's what keeps them attached to the organization. And then the best performing students, they also become part of our team, so that we are able to scale our operations. And for them, currently the prime motivation is non-economic benefits. So that would be more the career development aspects. We're helping them a lot with CV building and networking and recommendation letters and stuff like that. But in the future, we do want to, if the organization grows, we do want to work more with economic benefits. So that's for the first question. Then how do we measure their success? So now we look every, now as I mentioned in the presentation, we have case studies that we do on every enterprise. When we start with the organization, we have several topics that we look at, such as price at which they sell, the amount they sell, but that's more the profit metrics. And for some metrics that are a bit more softer, like entrepreneurial spirit, there's a more qualitative indicators that we use, and then we look how that proceeds, not just the 6 months after, but also over time, how that changes. And then the second question from Andrea, how do you the follow-up? I think that's a bit related to that. So we have fixed points in time at which we reconnect with the entrepreneur or the students to see if there has been any benefit from our program. So for the students, that we'll focus on first satisfaction and then the future once we've operated for a longer time and they've graduated, and we want to see if there has been a significant impact on their self-evaluation and their economic opportunities as well. But also what's very important for us is how they care about the communities, if they have continued to build projects in the community or help maybe a family member improve their business. That's a really important factor for us. Then how we, the link and the connecting, so how do we connect the students with the entrepreneur is basically we work through alliances. That's how we can work with the students and with the entrepreneurs. And subsequently, we will start the analytical process where we will go to that remote area and meet up with the entrepreneur or the group of entrepreneurs and have weekly meetings between the students and the entrepreneurs. And those trips are very, very organized. So the first year, I worked more on the operation side, so assuring that the team of analysts, of consultants, is on time and is able to reach the community. And the communication is a bit tricky because in some communities that we work with, there's no connection, basically. There's no mobile network, so that can be a bit tricky.
We need to get Ken there.
Yeah.
On there.
Yeah.
And a security business.
So that's all like based on talking and assuring that all the appointments are understood. And it has happened that we've shown up somewhere and it wasn't understood well, which is obviously not a very pleasant experience. But through time, you're able to once you build a relationship with that entrepreneur, you're able to improve on that part.
I was wondering, do you license, so let's say someone in this class, for example, wants to replicate that model in another Latin country, mm-hmm. would you license your training documents and stuff as to how you, and that process to someone else, or even give it away free? In the spirit of Ken, Ken is here.
Borrow that financial model.
But do you do that? Because there are loads of people that I was speaking to that they're thinking we can replicate this mm-hmm. in different ways in our, but the idea that they have to recreate their own curriculum and do mm-hmm. all that, sorry to put you on the spot. Yeah. Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah. As I mentioned, we've built up a very interesting curriculum of case studies now, we don't have a specific policy on it yet from the organization, but it would be definitely very interesting to have our model replicate in other areas, particularly by people that are from those areas or have lived in those areas, because that's a distinctive factor, I would say, of the model, that we work with local people and people that know the environment and know the problems of the entrepreneurs. So before I started with the curriculum, I looked into a lot of other micro-enterprise issues in Mexico, in Ghana, all over the world, and there were a lot of common tendencies among micro-enterprises, but obviously there's a very local element involved, local opportunities. For example, we work in Cusco, where you have restaurants, a lot of big restaurants and hotels, because it's a very touristic place, and those opportunities to connect with those players are not as present everywhere, so you need to find a local solution. But yeah, in conclusion, I would definitely be interested to work with you. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. Two questions. Ooh,
let's start. Okay. I'm Mauricio from Peru. Although my heart is urging me to ask you questions on El Salto or in Basilisa, I'd like to ask you a question too. I've seen your webpage and I've seen that you have already working. You are already working with big players in the cosmetic Chilean industry, such as Patricio and Pamela Grant, which are like.
Oh, you know them?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like well, I lived 5 years in Chile.
Oh.
So I kind of know.
How was that?
Do you like it?
Those are Chilean-based labels or brands. So my question would be, what strategies are you thinking about to influence international brands such as, I don't know, H&S, such as Natura, for example, or other brands that are very representative in the cosmetic Chilean market?
And then another question.
She was first.
Well, I'm Luisa, I'm from Mexico. I have been working in energy access through solar home systems. My question is to Ken. It takes me a lot what you mentioned about collaboration. And I really think we have to aim for a very collaborative space because we're all in this together and we all want to actually alleviate poverty by putting the community in the center. So in your experience, what's the way to do it or how can we promote?
Okay, excellent. So two questions. Shall we do a third? I'm breaking my rules.
Sorry, my name is Majo. I'm also studying the same master's degree as everybody from Mexico. My question is for Ken, one specific and then one for the whole panel. How does the business revenue work in your business? And then for everybody, what has been the most important challenge that you have to face?
We had to.
Like, what's the most challenging about your journey?
Okay, so just to remind you, Tea Project, certification of international brands, have they expanded their model to include that? For Ken, source of business revenue, what can we do to promote the idea that understanding the context and understanding the environment is probably the most critical part, and it's the part we leave out. Although in our degree, we have a whole course on that, so we don't leave it out understanding the problem. And then for the general panel, what's the most important challenge that you face? Okay, so let's start here, and you can answer all the ones that are relevant to you if you want.
Okay, so thank you for knowing, Chin. First of all, yeah, we got... So everyone get in the contest. We got the two most bigger cosmetic brands that are certified in Chile. The biggest laboratories in cosmetics, so we're really proud of that. And that has made this year, the last, I would say, a couple of months,
yes.
We faced a turning point of growth because those two brands, they have big marketing budgets also. So they created this huge marketing campaign talking about us and their certification. So that meant, like I just said, a turning point. We went from small to big in a month in terms of public. And that got mixed. And it was funny because it was in the same couple of months that we decided to expand. And then Lush Price came and everything. In the last couple of months, we haven't slept. It's incredible. So everything got joined together to have it for us a little bit easier to have a representation in each country. And as I was saying to you before, for us it's really hard because there's no one in the other countries doing the same thing. So we have no one to create an alliance. We would love to do it, but we have to start from scratch in each country. And in each country, they don't know Te Protejo, or maybe just a little bit. So we decided with Nicole that, first of all, the first year, maybe year or two or 6 months, we don't know, we're going to focus on social awareness because we can start certificating right now. But if no one knows us, our certification is worthless because our certification is valued in as much as people are valued it. So we're starting with people awareness and then to see how it works. Nicole can tell you a little bit more about it. Then we're going to start certificating with our logo. But at first, we already started working there. And as long as the bigger companies are giving us presence, that doesn't mean necessarily that it's going to be faster in other countries because the reality is different. So it's hard because we have to consider every country from scratch. I mean, they don't know anything about it. So it's not as fast to replicate the model as you would think because we are based on knowledge from people knowing us. So the 5 years that we spent of getting to this point, not necessarily it's going to be less time in other countries because we're starting just as scratch as we started in Chile. I don't know if you want to add something up.
Yeah, no, just saying that, in Chile it worked like that. We teach people, right? We inform consumers, and we want to do the same things in Peru, Colombia, Brazil, Mexico. There are the countries that we are now working. So it's going to be really like an education campaign, you know? What are you buying? You are making a vote by buying something, you know? Buy with a conscience. So that's the aim for 2018. And then, of course, we are going to be certificating also. But the main goal is to educate those consumers first.
Yeah.
And what's the biggest challenge that you guys have had?
I don't know. So many. No, well, I'm going to talk for myself. I think the biggest challenge was to try and think how to talk about something that no one wants to talk about and put it in a positive point of view, because no one wants to know that bunnies are dying because of your shampoo. I mean, who wants to know that? No one wants to see pictures. No one wants to... Everyone is just, okay, I'm going to forget I heard that. So the biggest challenge is to try to... like you said, you have to get your pitch ready. I've been working so hard, and I think we got it, to say it in a way that it's easy to understand and you don't want to stop thinking about it. Because for me, it was something so easy to get emotionally attached to, but I know that doesn't happen for everyone. I think, hopefully, there's a couple of vegetarians that can understand me. But it's not as hard to get that information to any person, and especially to people that are really concerned about beauty brands and about this whole consumption area that is not necessarily thinking about what's behind that, what's behind your makeup. And I understand that it's really important to be presentable, and just like you said before, also you have to represent your brand. People always laugh at the fact that I always wear makeup, I always get my hair done, and it's like, why? Just relax. It's like, no, I represent something, and it's important, and I understand that for other people. So the most challenges, just to sum it up, are two things: to trying to connect the message in a simple way and in a way that is not going to scare people away, and then the second part, trying to transmit the fact that I'm no hippie. I'm a vegetarian, yes. I have an NGO, yes, but I'm a professional too. And I have a business model too, and I make money, and I like money. I don't think money is a bad thing. So people go to one or the side. They don't want to hear about it, or they think we're just crazy people and we're going to attack a laboratory anytime soon. So we're on those two sides all the time, trying to convince people that we're not. We are professionals. I don't know, which are you?
No, I just would like to add that now we are working in a bill to, you know, end animal testing in cosmetics. So that's a challenge to explain people, to explain deputies, you know, to explain our chambers that this is an important thing. So communicating that is a challenge every day. So you have to explain them that we don't need to kill animals to use a shampoo. You know, so that's a challenge, of course.
Awesome. Evelyn, biggest challenge? I'll go down the
okay.
And then we'll end with Ken, because he has like four massive questions. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the biggest For our model, the difficulties, obviously we're a very labor intensive model, and that requires working with people, and so for people there's obviously a very there's a lot of different factors involved in implementing their goals, and specifically for the starting social enterprise, I would say that human capital retention is very important to maintain your institutional memory. And for a lot of social enterprises, including for ours, but also for a lot of social enterprises in Peru that I've spoken with, that is a big issue because there's it's a new industry. The ecosystem isn't very very strong yet, so there's not a strong supportive environment. So you need to rely on yourself and your own abilities. Obviously, also to network and engage with people. But that would be the biggest factor: finding out how you can keep the capable people attached to your organization, keep inspiring them and assuring that the passion they have for the project is, yeah.
Thank you, great answer. The reason why I interrupted is once anybody says human capital, like, working with people is a problem, like, yeah. Excellent point. Ileana?
Well, so surprisingly, my biggest challenge was not working. It wasn't the social part or the sustainability part. It was actually developing the product and telling people in the UK, you have the machine, I have the product, let's make it, and then convincing them to actually try to do it. Because I think 9 out of 10 suppliers was like, no, I've never tried it, I'm going to ruin it, take it to someone else.
Yeah, I can understand.
And it's frustrating when you're like, we can make something wonderful, but you have to give it a go. Mm-hmm. Convincing people to give it a go was the biggest challenge.
Because of the risk, right?
No, because they just don't want to try.
No.
Ken, you're listening to your question.
I'll do the easy one first. On the financial sustainability question, I never did really think about that. And it's probably a regret in a way. I was so focused on the product and the users and bringing down barriers that I just considered price putting up a new barrier. I spent years trying to lower barriers to entry, and I felt if you start to charge, then you're creating one. And I was very much about not creating barriers. So I stepped back in 2012, in fact, from the organization I started and let other people figure out the sustainability stuff because it's not my strong point. I think sometimes we need to be honest with ourselves and ask why we got into what we're doing. And I didn't get into this work to sit down and try and figure out business models. That's the most boring thing, I think, for me, I could ever have done. I want to be on the front line working with people and try to figure out how we can make technology as useful as possible. And so I was just very honest and said, this is not for me. Interestingly, though, there was a pivotal point. There's a brilliant management book called The Starfish and the Spider. I don't know how many people here have seen or read The Starfish and the Spider. It's an incredible book. It'll completely mash your brain up in thinking about organizational structures. It's all about headless organizations. It's about creating something that doesn't have a headquarters, doesn't have a center. So if you think about a lot of the open source kind of viral tools where if the music industry want to sue a company that's produced a file sharing tool, but there's not a company behind it, there's not a brass plaque at an office somewhere, there's not a director to go for, you can't actually sue people because there's no one to actually sue. So at the time, I was thinking with my product, how could I make my product run as it is without there being an organization behind it? So I was thinking about actually taking it back to the beginning. It built up very well and got this huge following, and I thought, can I take it back to nothing so that there's no cost and yet it's maintained? But then the Omidyar Network, who's the founder of eBay's charity, they offered us $1 million. And that...
And you said no.
And I said yes. It's ironic that $1 million was probably the worst thing that could have happened to me at that time, because my thinking was going down a very different channel, and I just thought, well, we should take it and just grow traditionally. But I would challenge anyone in the room who's thinking about scaling an organization or creating sustainability to not just think about the traditional way of doing it. Starfish and the Spider is just a really interesting alternative model, and it will actually make you think very differently. So I totally recommend that. So that was a regret for me. On the solar one, I think it's fair to say there's probably enough solar solutions now for most needs out there. I mean, there's more products than you can throw a solar lamp at. And some are better than others, and some are better at empowering the community than others. And then you've got MCOPA in, you know, in Kenya, where people end up owning the thing that they buy because of a clever kind of franchise stroke, you know, hire purchase stroke system. I would advise anyone who's interested in that kind of thing to spend a bit of time just A, studying the market.
Sorry, we do it, and it's owner, and we have...
Oh, so you're doing it already, okay.
7 years. But yeah. The question was more on the side of how we promote collaboration between to avoid the kid, like with the two organizations, I will vaccinate you.
Yeah.
Because everyone here will eventually go to somewhere else, and how do we promote collaboration for actually changing the system for a more participatory one instead of I will...
I mean, you know, sadly, you need someone else to believe in collaboration to be able to collaborate. You can't collaborate on your own. It sounds like an obvious thing, and a lot of people don't want to collaborate. It's just there's just too much ego and other craziness involved. All I would say to you is, if you have a set of values that you work to, that you're open to collaboration, you share everything that you're doing and why you're doing it and what's driving you, and you share user stories, and you're just the most open organization that you can be, and you put those values on the front of your website. So we had, I think, about 8 values for Frontline SMS, and it was front and center, and every staff member was indoctrinated in those values. And so we just thought we can maybe change the environment by just showing that there's another way of doing it and living the values that we say that we stand by. And I think that's all you can do, actually, to be honest with you. Hope that you can start a movement that starts to take things in the right direction. It takes a long time. I mean, I've been writing about the things I've been talking about this morning for, like, you know, over a decade. And I don't know if much has changed in that 10 years, but I still believe in what I'm saying, and I'll keep saying it till I die. And I think if enough people think that way, and then you can start to build a community. So I would, if your doors are open and you're always giving the message that you're open, people will start to come to you at some point. But I would say ignore all the ego and ignore all the politics. Just ignore it. If it hurts, still ignore it. Social media is a really good example of how people put their foot right in it by responding to things they shouldn't respond to. Donald Trump's a great example. You know, things just become perpetuated nonsense, and you have so much energy wasted. So I would say just be very open and honest. Ignore the people who are doing things in a way that you don't approve of, if they're attacking the way you're doing it, and it will just change. And that's not really a great answer, but it's a tough one. But you're doing it the right way if you're doing it that way.
Can I add something? I'm sorry, I'm going to jump
no, you
in
add.
There. I would add just one quick thing. You collaborate with people who trust you. I mean, that's why you are collaborating. So in order to get someone to trust you, they have to get to know you. So as you said, in Latin America is very different. We have like 70 coffees before we sign anything. So I think it's important if you are working in South America and you're trying to get local people to collaborate, or even other companies that are working on the same area, they have to trust you. And that's similar to what you said about putting everything out there. Maybe it's enough for your website, or maybe it's enough that you're going to have to go to the house of the person and actually be really transparent with what you're doing and have a meaningful relation. I think that's really important to have collaboration.
And then, can I get your challenge? Your main challenge? Number one challenge?
Oh, whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
that was a hard one.
biggest challenge. I don't actually, I'm sure I know it, but it's not jumping to the front of my, my consciousness. I mean, there's lots of challenges, whether there's one big one.
Yeah.
And when you have a lot of things you're fighting against, it's hard to put them in an order of priority, I think.
Which is the one that shocked you? Like, you were going along, and everybody has this in their lives, or in their, which is the one that really just kind of stomped you and made you think, whoa.
Well, I think that the realization that something I believed in, that local communities had everything they needed to solve their own problems if you trusted them enough.
Yeah.
It's a really simple one.
Yeah.
But most NGOs don't trust the people they're trying to help. If you come back to that trust point that you mentioned. Yeah. Like they don't think these people are able to drag themselves out of poverty. And I think the stuff you're doing is exactly the same.
Yeah.
So I think it was that when I started getting these amazing uses of the platform I developed from people who had, they did things I never imagined. So that it reinforced a belief I had, but I had no proof for it. And I think that was a big deal to suddenly be able to say, look at all this stuff that people are doing. And these are supposedly the illiterate, poor, downtrodden, lazy types who aren't actually willing to do anything that are doing this stuff. So stuff your theory and let's build more stuff like this. That was probably it.
That's awesome. Okay, so two questions, but I'm going to cheat and have mine first. It's to actually Ileana because it's for the class. There's several people in this class who actually are involved in crafts, like the front. I know you do in Naipaul. I know you've been involved in Colombia. I know there are other people. And if you had to give them advice, because you actually are starting a business from scratch, but they're on the lower end of the market, and if they had to elevate their brands from the lower, you're probably more middle, but from the lower end of the market into the sort of higher end, what are the one or two things that you would recommend to them? So you can think about that. And now, as the polite host, I will. Do you have a question? Yeah.
So my name is Sarah Yun. I work for a humanitarian organization, and I'm also doing a part-time master's program in social innovation. I have a question for Ken. And because you mentioned that only 1% of humanitarian aid going to the empowerment of local population. But at the moment, I agree with the statement, but at the moment, the humanitarian sector is facing two challenges. One is time, and the second one is neutrality. So for example, like in Iraq, we send doctors to treat wounded ISIS soldiers. So people are dying in front of you, so we need to treat them as quickly as possible. So we need trained doctors. At the same time, local doctors are not really reluctant to treat ISIS soldiers because their family members killed by the same people. And how do you overcome these challenges in the humanitarian sector and try to empower the local population?
You're on the LSE, Kenneth. If you know these questions, excellent questions.
I can do that in 1 minute. Yeah.
And then one more question. I'll do this and then I'll do a last. Whoa. Okay, we may have to go into questions after. But
hi, I'm Antonia. I'm doing the Development Management Masters, and I'm right now doing a project evaluating the impact of social investment. So this is a question for everyone. Just if you have experience or knowledge of funding your organizations or other organizations who've done this with social investments, and you know what you think of them, if there's a positive impact, if they're useful, or if donations are typically better.
Okay. So we'll start with actually Ileana and Ken, and then we'll go to the whole table. And then what I can do is maybe when we come back for lunch, we'll do a few more questions and then go into the theaters. Just know that Ken has to run a little early, so it's really important we get his presentation first, and then you can ask him questions, and then we'll allow you to. We may allow
you. You'll allow me to go.
Yes, may.
The ball and chain
may
if they are not.
You.
Okay, that's fine.
Yes, okay. So let's start, Ileana. So for the people in the classroom who want to elevate their brand.
Right, so have to upscale. So I did say about the brand when I was talking about my presentation, your brand is basically your currency. It is what you will be pitching, because if you are doing crafts and you're doing design, it changes seasonally. So what is in fashion 1 year will be out of fashion the next, even like in a month. So by establishing your brand, you can have the continuity of a continued purchase, whether it is from a retailer or from a customer. The second, it's know your market. You need to know which nations you're targeting, the age, sort of what groups their style, and know how to interpret their style with your brand, which is the same thing as knowing, it goes hand in hand with knowing your customer, but like the customer is more specific, like how much do they spend, where they spend it, do like the research about who you're trying to reach. Because that will influence your design. And this sounds a bit sort of crude and very businessy, but ethnical things are beautiful, but they become like handicrafts, things that you bring on as souvenirs. And you don't want that for your brand. What you want is something that is stylish, that is fashionable, that is designed, that you will see it down a catwalk, that you would think, oh, I really, really want those earrings. And then go like, oh, and it's amazing that it's inspired in this beautiful traditional design. It's that has to become the story behind it and not the forefront. And then with that in mind, placing it in the right stores, and then it comes down to what we were talking about of saying, you need to mingle, you need to have coffee, you need to say hi to everyone, learn their names, their children's names, where they went to school and where they hang out. Getting into the right stores will make you reach your customers. So it's sort of like a chain, and it's like, it's a catch 22 because you have to do the whole sort of doing one to get the other one done. But that's sort of the basic lines. I would obviously be happy if you have like particular questions about a particular product to answer them to the best of my abilities. But in general, that would be my suggestion.
So like with Tom's Shoes, you don't think leading with the story? I mean, Tom's Shoes are the most basic shoes. Anywhere you go in the world, they're like...
Yeah, it's Padrino.
But he led with the story and he was able to charge 100 US.
Because he knew his customer. He knew his customer was... laid back, concerned about the world, wanted to make a change, and was willing to spend more money because it created an impact. Because if you tell me like, oh, it's, I mean, I have tons of Toms. If you tell me it's £35 for a shoe, but if you pay 45, a kid is going to get shoes. I'm like, I will pay 45 to give that little child some shoes. And I will go to bed a happy person knowing that I put some, you know, shoes on the bare feet of a child in the middle of nowhere. He knew his customer and he knew what they were willing to spend and how much they were willing to spend, which is why it became a success. It's the same thing with, there's a Colombian designer, Paula Dominguez, I think. She makes this jewelry design and she sells it at Selfridges for like gazillions of dollars. And it's all inspired in the indigenous community of the Cauca region of Colombia. I don't think that she makes it with the indigenous community, but she knew what she was doing, but she took the artistry and turned it into something that the European consumer would like. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why there's like they're beautiful, but they're not, you know, they're not worth their weight in gold. Like they're not worth 500 pounds of gold.
Yeah.
And that's how she managed to establish a brand.
No, awesome. Ken. The $1 million question.
And I can't it's a question for a week, really, a week seminar. I mean, you're right. It's horrifically complex, and I think that the message I wanted to give more than anything was that it was the contradiction in the messaging. So, if you read any development literature or you read a lot of social innovation or social entrepreneurship work, it has the word empowerment in it. And so we talk about empowerment. It also has capacity building in it a lot. If you're genuine about capacity building in the countries where the problems are and where the local people live with those problems, only spending 1% of the money doesn't to me signify a genuine commitment to capacity building. And there are complications in that. I agree that, you know, there's all sorts of issues. I spent time in Malawi recently looking at why teachers didn't show up to school. You know, before I got there, I thought, my God, teacher's not going to school. That's a new one on me, right? I mean, usually the kids aren't going in. But you spend a week with teachers and you realise how darn difficult their lives are because of all the issues they're trying to face in their teaching careers. I wouldn't go to school if I was a teacher in Malawi, seriously. So there's always below the layers, there's always, you know, a lot more complexities than we like to think. I mean, I agree, I don't have answers to the questions you point out. But the thing I would say is if I see someone talking about capacity building and empowerment and they then go and do something which does nothing like that, I think that's either immoral, it's lying, it's misleading, it's wrong. And we all like to feel great about aid money, but if you go on the street now and ask 100 people where they think most aid money is spent, most people will probably say poor countries. I mean, it's like a natural thing, right? Isn't that what it's for? I think they'd be horrified to think that it was all going, you know, large part going to the benefactors, the people who give it. You know, the donors taking most of the money and hiring lots of people. So that was the message I was trying to give, but I agree it's complicated. The reasons they often give for not giving more money to developing countries is that the NGOs there don't understand the forms. That's a real excuse. If the forms are wrong, let's change the forms, right? I mean, come on, let's be serious. They can't handle the levels of money they have to be given. I think for DFID, having 0.7% of GDP to spend, which will be £20 billion a year, is a problem. It's really hard to find good things to spend that money on. It's too much. You could do a lot better with a lot less money if you did do more empowerment and capacity building genuinely. Yeah. But, you know, DFID wouldn't exist if it did all that properly, because it wouldn't be, all those jobs would be in the countries where the problems are.
Excellent answer, actually. We have to talk about impact.
Oh, there was an investment one, wasn't
yes,
there?
Which yes.
Social investment one.
Oh, yes. Oh.
And then I'll take two last questions quickly, but we have to go to lunch because we have to feed. Come on.
We're hungry.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then we'll come back and then we'll do failures, but we'll take additional questions at the end also, okay? So, a quick one on your view on the best way to, I think, invest and build your organization, donations versus social investment. Let's do a quick fire answer.
Just receiving social investments, because a lot of social investment money comes from the UK, US, Canada, to sort of social enterprises elsewhere. And I was wondering if you have any experience with that and what that has been like.
Well, we are NGO, so people think immediately that we receive funding. But we don't like funding, because we think that a sustainable NGO or any social entrepreneur has to be able to maintain itself. So we love funding, but like we've received one in 5 years, because we're not focused on getting funding. We're focusing on getting our business model sustainable. So I think it could be tricky and it could be deceitful, because you can think that you have a lot of money, but how can you sustain that? I mean, you cannot base your business model on getting free money to do whatever you want every single year for the rest of your life. So I think when someone says like they are based on donations or social or responsible areas and in the companies, I think it could be misleading, because from 1 year to another you can run out of money and then you don't have where to get it. So for us, for our business model, it's like an extra, and we want it and we need it also, because we're not millionaires. But we don't agree as a base of any organization. I don't think it should be supported, because you have to be able to maintain yourself if you want to grow. I don't know if you want to add something. Yes. Quick question.
Yeah. So for my organization, we are still depending on donations, but working on the cross-subsidy model at the moment. Social investment specifically, we haven't been in contact with it, and I think usually for our organization, because we're just 1.5 years operating, that's not something that we need to think of right now. Maybe in the future, that could be a factor, but social investment as such is not... That's not entered our strategy.
Well, in my case, I'm a for-profit company. I just happen to be socially responsible, so I don't receive donations. I would get investors, which I am trying not to do for as long as possible. But I do apply to lots of grants, and then that usually brings in like a nice, like a cool 5-10K that gives us prototype money or gives us something else. So there's lots of awards and prices for like the most ridiculous things. You'd be surprised. Not really, they really are.
I think on the investment side, it totally depends on who your investor is. I've been really lucky. I've raised money, private money, twice for two companies I've started, and the investor's been a very silent, quiet, patient, understanding investor.
Where did you get those investors? Because all the ones that have approached me are
met them over brownie and coffee. And so I think a lot depends on that. If you get...
Tell people about what I do with your company. Yeah.
So it can go terribly wrong as well, though. So, you know, you are, as the point you made, you know, you're opening yourselves up to potential disruption. And so my experience of that's been very good, but that's because of the investor, I would say. Donations are brilliant. It's free money. No strings attached, usually. Donors rarely read the final report. Usually don't care what you've done with their money as long as you've spent it. Sadly true, in my experience. The only thing we've had trouble with was social investment. We created a kick community interest company in the UK for Frontline SMS, and nobody understood what it was. Donors hated it because they couldn't quite figure out, you know, whether it was a company or not a company. Investors hated it because of the asset locks and all sorts of other fancy stuff that's attached to it. We shut it down.
Wow. So the answer is no.
It all depends.
Yes.
not in this case.
No, I'm teasing. Okay, this is going to be, the last two questions are going to be quick-fire questions, to be quite honest, so that we can go and have lunch and be back by 2, because we have a session this afternoon that's extremely exciting about failures, which is sort of, you tend to not discuss it, so I'm really, you know, I'm sure you want to come back to that. So your question, yes?
My question is to Ileana. I wanted to understand more about your social impact in your company, so the relationship you have with manufacturers. In the ground.
Okay, and one more. Last one,
Prakash.
Yeah.
Okay, my question is to Ken. Ken, I was actually interested when you say only one person that demanded to win points goes to actual management issue. I've seen that when there was earthquake in Nepal, a lot of charities wanting to go to these places which are more accessible, and usually a lot of places which are very remote and rural, they are not actually accessible for this kind of funds and opportunity. So I wanted to ask you what kind of developmental shift is needed to actually have these funds go to those areas, and also how the organization based in rural and remote areas can actually tap these resources and scale their programs.
Do you tell them why you're asking that? Tell them about your social enterprise.
Yeah, so I'm from one of the most remote part of Nepal. We didn't still have access to road and electricity, and that's where my schools are based, which I'm the founder and director of, and I have this kind of challenge because it's very hard for us to tap resources and funds because not a lot of people or investors or donors want to give money to these kind of areas because it's hard for them to track one thing, and another thing is it's hard for us to scale very fast because of geographical difficulties and all the issues like technology and stuff like that.
Excellent. He runs two schools and he also runs an orphanage in one of the most remote parts of Nepal. You have to, his story is just, I mean, so many stories of the class. I mean,
yeah,
you don't have
sure.
time to meet everyone. But it'll just blow your mind, the passion we have in this room for social enterprise. So, first question. Ileana.
Right, social entrepreneurship part. What we do is solely in Peru, so we cut the intermediaries that would dilute the earnings of the indigenous community. So for out of those $600 per kilo, they would usually get like $300. So what we do is we make sure that they get the $600. And then we process all our wool, like our hair, here in the UK, and we view it as well. So there's no social entrepreneurship on that side. We just work with a mill that it took me forever to find. And we work with a weaving company that was actually surprisingly easier. And it happened that it was an all-female mill. So we have that going. So it's really an all-female company all around, except for the spinners, the people who spin the wool in Lancashire, who is a family-run company. So it's social responsibility in Peru and sort of like small business in the UK.
Okay, excellent. And Ken?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was just thinking about the best way to answer it. I mean, there's different types of humanitarian funding, right? So you have DFID and USAID and government money, and that's the big, massive pots of money. But then there's lots of, in the US in particular, like family foundations. You have the MacArthurs, the Rockefellers, the Hewletts, and they're a lot more flexible often in, and Gates, of course, in how they give. I mean, if you're struggling with the kind of the track record, the responsibility, credibility piece in a way, right, which they won't give you money because they don't know you and don't trust you and don't know how you're going to spend it. I mean, one thing you could do is try to find an organization that will do a fiscal sponsorship for you. So if you want to raise money in the US, you often have to be a 501c3 tax exempt foundation yourself to be able to give them the tax breaks that they need. But if you don't have that, you can find a 501c3 that will do a pass through, and they'll take responsibility for the money, take 20% of it, and give you the rest, and you don't have to be a 501c3 then. So you can use an established, trusted body to apply for the money, and the donor will see those as being the ones responsible, and they will be a US based foundation, and they will take some money away and then give you the rest, and you'll have to report back to them, and they'll then do the reporting back to the big donor. I mean, sounds to me like that would be one that's worth looking at for you, but then also to maybe research foundations and challenges, dare I say it, which have a particular focus on the kinds of things that you're doing. So, for example, the GSMA just announced a fund with DFID, funnily enough, a 300 million fund looking at building solutions in disaster hit areas. It sounds like you're responding, you know, in part to that. So there might be some funds in there. So research, I guess, looking for a fiscal sponsor. And also, if you need help, maybe writing grant proposals that speak the language of the donors, because people struggle with that a lot. You know, now in the days of the gig economy, I mean, almost all the work I do, I just build remote teams to do stuff. I pay someone £100 to do a piece of work for me, and I use Upwork, which is a brilliant site for finding people. Right now on my app I'm building, I've got a programmer in Zimbabwe, and I've got an autistic guy in Scotland doing my testing, because autistic people are brilliant at software testing. And I'm just paying really small amounts of money to a virtual team that I've built. So maybe if there's any skills gaps that you're missing around finding the money and doing a proposal and filling in a form, maybe if you've got a little bit of money, you can invest in finding a good grant writer somewhere using a gig economy type site who can help you shape something in a language which won't scare a donor so much. It's maybe two or three. But I'm happy to chat afterwards if you want to.
Okay, thank you so much for the gift.